Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 19, 2018. State aims to boost retirement savings. Employees can opt out of program employers will be required to offer. Illinois is poised to begin a program next month that requires many employers to help establish voluntary retirement savings plans for employees and to offer automatic payroll reductions to do it. The program, known as Secure Choice and established by the legislature in 2015, eventually could cover 1.2 million Illinoisans, State Treasurer Mike Furyk said Wednesday at a retirement planning seminar at the iHotel and Conference Center. This dramatically increases the number of people who are saving their own money for their retirement, said Furyk, chairman of the 7-member board overseeing operation of the savings program. This is not a state-defined benefit program. This is not Social Security. This is giving people the tools they need to invest in themselves so that they have a brighter retirement. All employees in Illinois that have been in business for 2 years and have at least 25 employees must either offer their own retirement plan or participate in Secure Choice, Furyk said. Employers do not have to contribute to the program, nor do they have to pay a fee to participate. Secure Choice will begin next month with employers that have voluntarily agreed to participate. In October, Furyk said, the largest employers in the state will have to begin signing up, followed by medium and small-sized firms in 2019. We're going to roll this out over a few different phases to make sure we work out all the problems and all the bugs, he said. Panelists agreed that many Americans aren't saving enough and that they are underestimating their lifespan, leading to individual financial problems. Ron Pressman, CEO of financial services firm TIAA, said the United States has a pending retirement crisis because one-third of Americans have nothing saved at all for their retirement, and that one-third of middle-class Americans are convinced they'll have to work until they die to sustain themselves. Furyk said that under Secure Choice, employers automatically will have 5% of their income directed into a savings account, a Roth IRA, but that they can increase or reduce the percentage. They also can opt out of the program. About 20% of those who were enrolled in Oregon's First in the Nation program have opted out, according to Oregon Saves. The Oregon program began last July. The vast majority of people, when they're enrolled, stay enrolled, Furyk said. Everyone knows they need to save for their retirement. We just put it off because it's too difficult, it's complicated, it's confusing, or I can't put the money aside today. But when we help them take it out of their paycheck, where they don't have to do anything, they don't miss the money. Most people continue to save, they stay in the program. A demographic study of the program done for the Secure Choice Board estimates that the employment sectors with the greatest percentages of employees without retirement plans are accommodations and food services, as well as arts, entertainment, and recreation. Furyk and Jeffrey Brown, dean of the U of I's Geese College of Business, agreed that a federal savings program would be preferential to individual state initiatives. But we sat back and waited for Congress to act. It didn't. He stressed that Illinois state government would not touch the money. Just to be clear, although the program is overseen by the state, those accounts are owned by the individual participants and held in a trust outside of state government, Furyk said. This money will never be part of the state's general revenue fund and cannot be used for other purposes. Honest, no kidding, it cannot happen. He turned to other panelists, some of whom are not from Illinois, and said some of people in this community have concerns about state government. The audience laughed. As Census Incorporated of Dresher, Pennsylvania, the largest independent retirement and college saving service provider in the country, will manage the program. A census also runs the Oregon program. Charter school backers meet Unit 4 deadline. Backers of a proposed charter school say they hope the 20-plus pages of documentation submitted Wednesday will provide the clarity Champaign school district officials said were missing during a contentious hearing earlier this month. School board president Chris Klopel identified to the News Gazette that the district received the addendum to North Champaign Academy's application before the end of business Wednesday, the revised deadline Unit 4 set last week. Among other things, the NCA packet included a more detailed budget breakdown. It calls for the district to provide $11,876 to cover the cost of each student's attendance, what's known as per capita tuition. With enrollment at the K-5 school now projected to be 128 students, that amounts to $1,520,128. During the April 9th hearing, Klopel and Crisp and school board members pointed to 116 questions they had about NCA's original application. Since the charter school needs Unit 4 support and financial backing to proceed, Superintendent Susan Zola said part of the district's role in the process is to vet the application and determine how it aligns with state school code. We are committed to the process and have submitted our responses as a clarification of the district's core questions, NCA Steering Committee member Walker said Wednesday. We look forward to the district's decision and a community collaboration for the success of the North Champaign Academy. The next known key date in the process is 13 days away. At 5:30 p.m. May 2nd, the district will hold a special meeting to provide a final written decision on approval or denial of the NCA's February 26th proposal, Zola informed NCA leaders in an email. Bon Ton Stores bankruptcy. Bergner's closing by the end of August. The local Bergner's is expected to close by the end of August after liquidators bought its parent company Bon Ton Stores in a bankruptcy auction. While a manager for the Champaign store at Marketplace Mall declined to comment, as did Marketplace, the location was listed in court documents among Bon Ton's more than 250 stores that liquidators plan to close. And a statement from Bon Ton's CEO indicated all stores would be closing. While we are disappointed by this outcome and tried very hard to identify bidders interested in operating the business as a going concern, we are committed to working constructively with the winning bidder to ensure an orderly wind down of operations that minimizes the impact of this development on our associates, customers, vendors, and the communities we serve, CEO Bill Tracy said. We are incredibly grateful to all of our associates for their dedicated service to Bon Ton and to our millions of loyal customers who we have had the pleasure to serve as their hometown store for more than 160 years. Bon Ton filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in February, but was unable to find a buyer willing to continue operating the business. Bon Ton also operates Carson's stores, including the one at the Village Mall in Danville. Bon Ton had already announced in January that store would be closing along with 40 others. The liquidation sale there has already started and is expected to continue through the end of the month. On Wednesday afternoon, the 154,000 square foot Bergner's in Champaign showed no signs of an impending liquidation sale. As she was entering the store, Liz White of Loda said she'd be disappointed to see it close. This is probably our go-to spot for shopping for women's clothes, she said, while shopping with Sandra Hackle. If I had a choice between Macy's, Bergner's, and JCPenney here in the mall, I'd probably go to Bergner's just because it's convenient and they have good choices, and I think their prices are certainly comparable, Hackle said. As Ruth Landry of Champaign was leaving Bergner's, she said she won't miss it too much. It's just not really worth shopping at, she said. We have grandkids of an age that are looking for tween or teen-type things, and they've got nothing. She said she used to shop there regularly, but hasn't as much in the past couple years. I can order online, or I can go to a store where I feel like I'm getting something that not everybody else will buy and is a little bit different. Landry said she's worried about what the store closing would mean for the mall. I'm fine if Bergner's goes, but I'm sad for the mall. To the extent that it's just more huge space, it's going to be empty or turned into something that's not really probably useful or needed, she said. Bon Ton's liquidation comes soon after retailers Toys R Us announced last month that it would be closing all of its 740 U.S. stores, including one in Champaign. Chaz Ebert announces that she's co-producing film on Sojourner Truth. The first lady of Roger Ebert's film festival was late getting to town Wednesday, flying in too late from Los Angeles for a scheduled morning radio appearance. But Chaz Ebert wasn't about to miss the opening of the 20th annual film festival, sponsored by and named for her late husband. The wife of Pulitzer Prize-winning movie critic Roger Ebert, an Urbana native and University of Illinois graduate, kicked off Ebertfest at an opening night gala at the U of I President's House in Urbana. Festival supporters, special guests, and sponsors packed the invitation-only reception hosted by President Tim Killeen and his wife, Roberta Johnson Killeen, while munching on hors d'oeuvres and sipping champagne or sparkling water. They were formally welcomed to the event by Killeen, U of I College of Media Dean Wojciech Chadzko-Jacko, and Eberfest Director Nate Cohn. But the star of the event was clearly Chaz Ebert herself, who bravely greeted and mingled with friends and fans alike while hobbled by a pair of painfully uncomfortable strapped shoes. She then treated the appreciative crowd to a healthy few laughs as she made her way through a long list of guests deserving of recognition. Among them were directors Andy Davis, Julie Dash, and Ama Asante, and film legend The Big Lebowski inspiration Jeff Dowd, whom she claimed to have partied with and rescued from being thrown out of more than one such affair, as well as a host of film critics led by Leonard Maltin, Michael Phillips, and Richard Roper. As proof that Eberfest is still going strong after 20 years, and that its namesake's impact on his hometown hasn't diminished in the least, Chaz Ebert and Cohn took advantage of the occasion to publicize other events and programs bearing Roger Ebert's name and carrying on his legacy, including the creation of the Ebert Center on the U of I's Urbana-Champaign campus, which is scheduled to hold its inaugural Eberfest Symposium on Empathy and the Universe October 1st. Perhaps the biggest announcement at the opening gala was Chaz Ebert's introduction of a couple of guests with whom she is involved in producing an upcoming movie about the life of Sojourner Truth, an African-American abolitionist, women's rights activist, and escaped slave. She introduced the film's director, producer Latif Cal Calloway, as well as Burl McLeachy, a sixth-generation descendant of Truth, who is serving as a consultant on the project. McLeachy said he has been touring full-time for several years while telling his forebears' story, which is how he met Calloway and how the idea for the film was born. Calloway said the film has been cast and filming is due to begin early next year. But he declined to reveal any of the actors or actresses signed on so far, other than to confirm that it will be a biopic. The evening's gala was different from previous ones in at least two different respects. For one, it was held indoors due to the unseasonably chilly weather outside. Second, Chaz Ebert said she was inviting Killeen and Chadzko to join her on stage at the Virginia before the start of The Fugitive, which Cohn described as the perfect opening night film to welcome the festival's fans as well as its sponsors. Late discovery of police video leads to mistrial. A Champaign County judge Wednesday declared a mistrial for an Urbana man accused of trying to get teen girls into his car because the state failed to turn over squad car videos related to his arrest. Judge Heidi Ladd agreed with Desit Tekle's attorney that the state had violated the discovery process, the exchange of evidence between attorneys, but found the prosecutor's omission was not intentional, setting the stage for a retrial. Tekle, 23, who lives in Rainbow View Drive with several relatives, was charged in November with child abduction after he allegedly approached two different girls who were both 13 on November 1st as they walked near Urbana Middle School and offered them rides. Neither girl got in the car and neither was physically harmed. Laying out the facts of how Tekle approached the girls and what he said to them, Assistant State's Attorney Tim Sullivan told the jury the evidence supported a guilty verdict on child abduction charges. Defense attorney Evan Bruno said evidence would show that Tekle, an immigrant from Eritrea, East Africa, lawfully in the country since 2014, was trying to be kind to the girls and had no criminal intent in speaking to them. He said Tekle was at the school to take his nephew to basketball practice. Tekle had a court-appointed translator to help him understand what was being said during the trial. Stranger danger is not a thing in Eritrea. No one ever told Desit to be afraid of strangers. They probably should have. This is a case about imagination and fear, Bruno told the jury in opening statements. Girl aggressive behavior. Both girls, now 14, testified that Tekle approached them at different times. One girl was walking north on Vine Street about 4:30 p.m., headed to her piano lesson downtown, when a man she identified as Tekle pulled across the crosswalk on Oregon with his car blocking her ability to cross Vine. He asked me if I was okay because I looked upset and did I need a ride, the teen testified. She told him no, but she described him as becoming more aggressive and saying, "Baby, you need a ride. I'll give you a ride." The girl said she called her mother, who called the police. She said Tekle called her baby about 5 to 10 times and asked her to get in the car about 10 times. She said he seemed to have no trouble understanding her and did not appear confused. The other girl said she left basketball practice at the middle school about 6 p.m., walked to the nearby gas station on Vine, and was walking back to school to wait for her dad to pick her up. As she neared the school, she said Tekle pulled his passenger window down and asked her if she was okay and did she need a ride home. She told him no at least 3 times, she said, then went back into the school. She told her father what happened, adding that she thought she saw something in his hand that she believed was a knife. Her father relayed that to police, and Officer Eric Ruff, who is also the earlier report from the other girl, arrived at the school. Ruff testified Tuesday that he ordered Tekle out of his car at gunpoint and had him put on his hands over his head and walked to the back of the car. He said Tekle complied and had no difficulty understanding. Under cross-examination by Bruno, Ruff said he believed his dash cam was on when he was arresting Tekle, a revelation that caused Bruno and Sullivan to approach the judge. Ladd sent the jury out, and a lengthy exchange followed about Sullivan not sending Bruno all the video that existed from the arrest, as Bruno had requested in December. Sullivan told the judge he was unaware of squad car video. Typically, he said, a police officer notes in his written report if there is video, and a non-attorney in his office asked the department's evidence technician to produce it. If it exists, it's sent to the state's attorney's office, he said. State's attorney Julia Reed said Sullivan requested all video from Urbana Police and did not receive it. Ladd sent the jury home, ordered Sullivan to get the video, and handed over to Bruno early Wednesday morning to review it. When the lawyers came back before Ladd at 10:30 a.m., Bruno had a long list of items he found on the video that would have caused him to defend Tekle differently, and he noted that the girls and their parents had already testified, so his opportunity to cross-examine them on things he learned by watching the video was gone. My strategy may have been totally different, knowing Ruff's report is misleading on Desit understanding his rights, Bruno argued, referring to his client's limited understanding of English. Sullivan countered that Bruno could have filed a motion to suppress evidence stemming from the arrest, but did not, that Bruno could continue to cross-examine Ruff about the details of the arrest, and that there was little on the approximately 100 minutes of video that would exonerate Tekle. Bruno took issue with that. I don't tell the prosecutor where to find inculpatory evidence, and I don't expect him to point out exculpatory evidence. That's my job, and that's why I requested the videos in December, Bruno said. Ladd agreed that Bruno should have had more time to review the videos on his own and with his client. To ask him to sift through 90 to 110 minutes of video and be prepared to question the witnesses is unfair, and no effective defense attorney could do so given the extent of material produced late, Ladd said. This is unfortunate but preventable, she said of the mistrial. After the hearing, an exasperated Bruno said, the goal was to get a not guilty, and this isn't the way we wanted the trial to end. He's been unemployable since November 1st as an accused child abductor. His schooling was ended. He was expelled from his CDL, commercial driver's license training. Ladd continued the case until May 22nd. We have some U of I sports news. Transfers affect upcoming roster. Trio of ex-Illini land at Missouri. Chris Tamas kept together a 9-deep freshman class after Illinois Volleyball hired him away from Nebraska in February 2018 to replace the departed Kevin Hambley. All 9 freshmen were Hambley's recruits, and 3, Megan Cooney, Morgan O'Brien, and Tiana Omazek, ended up playing important roles for the Illinois' 23-11 Sweet 16 team this past season. A third of that class has since transferred this offseason, and a fourth departure has left Illinois a bit thin on depth, with its spring season set to conclude 7:30 p.m. Friday in a match against Iowa State in Davenport, Iowa. "It's always kind of expected with the coaching changeover," Thomas said about the transfers. "Our message is always we just keep moving forward and we go with it." Merjek Van Dyke was the first to transfer, departing for Louisville. The 6'2" outside hitter appeared in just 9 sets spread across 6 matches in 2017 for the Illini. She'll play this fall for another former Nebraska assistant, Danny Busboom Kelly, with the Cardinals. Illinois' other 3 transfers will still be teammates next season. Omazek, fellow freshman Kylie Kuava DeBerg, and sophomore Annika Garreau have all announced they'll transfer to Missouri. That gives the Tigers some needed depth with just 7 players currently listed on their 2018 roster. In that group, Illinois lost a middle blocker, Omazek, that came on strong late in 2017 to finish 4th on the team in total blocks. An outside hitter, DeBerg, that was ranked the number 15 player in the 2017 class, and a defensive specialist, Groh, that averaged 1.53 digs per set. This season's transfers outnumber the players to leave the program from the previous 8 seasons combined. Kaylin Court transferred to Clemson after last year's coaching change. Jessica Jendrick left as a graduate transfer to St. Louis for the 2013 season. And Jasmine Orozco transferred to Pepperdine after the Illinois' 2011 national runner-up season. Transfers are still relatively new for the current Illini, but rising senior center Jordan Poulter echoed Chamas's moving forward sentiment. "I think everyone who's here wants to be here, and that's what we want," said Poulter, who will train in Anaheim, California this summer with the U.S. Women's National Team. "We're moving forward with a strong mentality moving into this summer and hopefully carrying that into the fall because we want to be better than we were last year." This offseason's transfer opened up 3 more scholarships for Illinois. Incoming freshmen Diana Brown and Taylor Cooper take the Illini to 9 filled scholarships of the 12 available, meaning Thomas has some flexibility to fill out his roster. "I'm very adamant about adding players that can add value, whether that's from them understanding the team culture we're building right now, or being able to play at this level," Thomas said. "A combination of both, really. That's kind of the biggest thing. We're not going to add people just to add bodies. We're going to make sure that they can add value to the program. Always on the lookout for any of those types of players. Adding any players before the start of the 2018 season would lend more depth to the Illinois roster. The Illini have just 2 middle blockers and 4 pin hitters, with help at those positions not coming until the 2019 and 20 classes. We have some good classes lined up," Thomas said. "They've got to fill maybe a few holes, but we have everyone we need to go through a season right now and more than happy working within this group." They're going to don the orange and blue. Beat writer Scott Ritchie breaks down the future Illini for the next 4 classes. Class of 2018, Diana Brown, the 6-foot setter from Columbus, Ohio, ranked the number 45 player in the 2018 class by Prep Volleyball, put up 479 assists, 206 digs, and 131 kills last season. Taylor Cooper, the 5'8 defensive specialist out of Lenexa, Kansas, led Olathe Northwest to a state title and ended the 2017 season with 472 kills, 270 digs, and 106 aces. Class of 2019, Ellie Holzman, the 6'2 New Orleans product, followed up her Max Preps National Sophomore of the Year honor in 2016. Riley Hinton, Champaign Central product, the 6'2 middle blocker for the Maroons, earned the News-Gazette All-State's honorable mention accolades. Kyla Swanson, the 6'3 middle blocker from Wahoo, Nebraska, helped lead the Warriors to a 34-2 season. Alisa Eske, a multi-sport athlete from Milwaukee, the 5'5 defensive specialist, helped Illinois-based Sky High 16 Black go to a 6-6 at last year's AAU National Junior Championships. Class of 2020, Raina Terry, a native of Marengo, Ohio, the 6'2 outside hitter, earned 2017 Max Preps All-American honors. Maddie Whittington, the 6'4 middle blocker opposite hitter from Stillwater, Minnesota, played a few points this past season after season-ending knee injury last summer. Class of 2021, Brooke Mosher, the 5'11 setter opposite hitter from Waterloo, Wisconsin, received Max Preps All-American honors after finishing the season. Men's basketball, building a culture. Underwood pleased with team's direction. Brad Underwood could come up with just two games during the 2017-18 men's basketball season where he felt his team didn't play hard. The January 18th Big Ten loss at Wisconsin is the most obvious. Illinois trailed by 11 at halftime before getting pasted in the final 20 minutes of an eventual 75-50 defeat. It was also the first time all season Underwood openly questioned the Illini's effort. But those 30 other games, execution could be questioned, results too in a 14-18 season, but hardly ever the effort. I fought really hard for that, and I think that was a challenge for them at different times, Underwood said. I go back to the everyday guy mentality. There's no days off and none in this league. We were two scholarships down. We knew that going in. We knew there were going to be some depth issues, but I feel like every single night we took the court, we had a chance to win. That's a tribute to our players and our staff for every night getting them ready to go to battle. Consistent effort is just a piece of the culture Underwood tried to instill in his first season at Illinois. He referenced culture a lot the last 11 months, particularly during the 4-month-plus stretch between the start of practice in early October and the season-ending defeat to Iowa in the Big Ten tournament the last day of February. Culture for Underwood is more than what happens on the court on game day, the wins and losses. It's the little things on which a program is built, like how the team approaches a shoot-around or class attendance. They're just the simplest things sometimes, but they're huge, he said. I've self-evaluated a lot here in the last month. I knew the 2017-18 season would be a process. I think any time there is a change made, there's reasons why it wasn't maybe what the old coach or old staff thought. You try to figure that out. You try to establish your identity and how you want things to be. Underwood knew the process in year one would have its share of frustrations. So much had changed from the year prior. Experienced, productive players gone, plenty of new faces, players and coaches. Everyone tried to adapt to a new system and style of play. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News-Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 19th, 2018. Please stay tuned for Part 2.